A big part of my life is my job. For most of us, except unless you're retired, a big part of our lives is our jobs. It's what we do to make a living. It's something that we do day in, day out. I am an IT manager, and so part of my job is to procure new software for end users, software that helps them to do their jobs better. It's also my job to make sure that this software is safe for them to use and make sure that they're using it in a way that is safe for the company. Now, recently, within the past probably 4 or 5 months, maybe a little bit longer, we are starting to use AI more and more at our company. In fact, our company has publicly stated that we have cut our workforce by 2/3 because of AI. But what they don't mention is the amount of work that goes on in the back end to make sure that the software is safe to use. They don't mention that the workload that is left to the few people left at the company is a lot. It's a lot to make sure that these systems are working properly, making sure that sensitive data is not being leaked, whether, you know, by accident, on purpose, whatever that might be. From my standpoint, this is a very frustrating experience. Something that, I mean, I've been working at this company for well over 14 years now, and I've helped build a lot of the systems that we use. The systems that we use, though, are growing exponentially. They're moving faster and faster. The pace is increasing. The ideas that are being brought forth are having to become reality faster. There is a certain amount of stress. There is a certain amount of chaos that is a byproduct of this speed. Now, I don't think that this is just something that I feel, and I don't think that this is just happening in my job alone. I think as a whole, the speed in which humanity is living has shifted. Not just at work, not just in our day-to-day lives, but it's happening at a pace that feels very different from what I remember growing up, what I remember being younger. We've crossed a line, and while nobody has said that, it can be felt. With AI, everything continues to speed up. It continues to accelerate at a pace that I don't think anybody really truly understands. But I think that this has been something that God saw was going to happen. He knew that this was going to come about at some point in time. And so, if you will, turn to Daniel chapter 12 and verse 4. And he tells Daniel, and then Daniel is writing this vision, and God says to Daniel, "Many shall run to and fro, and the knowledge shall increase." You see, this isn't some abstract end-time language anymore. It's a Tuesday afternoon, and I'm sitting at my desk trying to figure out how to integrate Claude into our work stack so that our developers can work faster. At the same time, I'm trying to understand how this is going to affect security for the company. I'm trying to figure out how all this falls under the regulatory compliance that we are subject to because we are a publicly traded company. At the same time, I'm trying to figure out how legal counsel thinks about what we are doing and, you know, talking with him and figuring out what is acceptable, what is not. AI is increasing knowledge at a pace that no human being can track. This running to and fro, this frantic pace of information, decisions, choices, it's all real. It's all right now. Daniel was told to seal that book at the end. But that means that that moment of when it was to be unsealed was always coming in the future. You can look at different points in history when the printing press was invented, when the television was invented, when the internet was invented in the beginning. And yes, all those are important milestones to the point we are now, but it all pales in comparison to what is happening. That seal is off. And we haven't even talked about quantum AI yet, or quantum computing. What happens when AI, artificial intelligence, and quantum computing merge? This is not some distant idea that, you know, some guys are writing about in science fiction books and movies. This is happening right now. There are researchers, there are tech companies, there are governments which are building hybrid systems that combine AI pattern recognition with quantum computing. And the implications are very scary. In October 2025, Google demonstrated a 13,000 times speed up of computing by using 65 qubits. I know this is computer jargon that's going to go over almost everybody's head. AI is now designing quantum chips better than humans can conceive of. In this year, 2026, processors exceeded thousands of qubits. Now, a qubit is a quantum bit. It's the basic unit of information. It's how your computers talk. Really, it's a mechanic of zeros and ones. But what happens with a qubit is that it's zeros and ones, or it can be a combination of a zero and a one. Now, you'll have to figure out how all that works on the back end, because I don't even understand it fully. But it's quite fascinating to think that's how computers are run. But experts are talking about a self-reinforcing loop. AI building better quantum computers, which help build better AI, which build better quantum computers. So when does it stop? You know, computing is just one of the areas that is increasing. I recently saw a video on YouTube of how AI invented a brand new type of rocket engine, one that human beings hadn't even thought of yet. And while that alone was fascinating, the whole design loop was being done by AI. And of course, there's human beings, you know, helping it to think and giving the initial guidance, but the whole system, from rendering the designs, iterating on those designs, running program loops and seeing how, you know, by modeling what would happen, and then creating the engine from a single cast die, and then taking that engine and hooking it up to real life propulsion systems, and then taking the data from those engines being hooked up to test runs, the whole process was really just run by AI. And they run it in a loop. And so it continually gets better, gets better, gets better. You see, it's no longer theoretical. The seal that Daniel was told to lock up, it's taken off. The knowledge explosion is happening right now. In Genesis chapter 11 and verse 6, God saw what the people were doing at the Tower of Babel. And these people were just, you know, working with mud bricks and simple engineering at that time. But what does he say? He says, nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. But that poses a problem for us. And I think that's part of the main reason why God scattered people at the time of Babel. It was moving too fast at that time. The time frame for human beings to live their 6,000 years was not right. The timing was not right, and so God put an end to that. He stopped it. And he will do the same in the near future. But before then, we continue on with our lives. Now in AI, there's a new thing that's happened within the last couple months. And this is called agents. And these agents are changing how people think about AI. They're changing how AI is used. So what is an AI agent? Well, an AI agent is something that you give a goal to, and then it runs. You can tell an agent to be a HR director, and you can give it your problems, and it can literally go and do the work for you and give you solutions, give you answers. It decides what steps to take, and it executes them, and it learns as it goes. And a lot of times, it can operate without humans checking on every decision. Now, the dangerous part isn't the capability. It's that, ultimately, if there is no definition, if there is no intent, no guardrails, it can do whatever it wants to, almost. You know, experts in the field of AI are quite worried about where the state of things is headed, because so many people have already started using AI and using these agents and building automated systems. In the International AI Safety Report from this year, 2026, led by the Turing Award winner Yoshiya Benigo and authored by over 100 AI experts, backed by over 30 countries, they concluded that AI agents pose heightened risk because they act autonomously, making it harder for humans to intervene before failures cause harm. You know, from my seat at work, these agents are being deployed across companies with little to zero regard given to what they can actually do. I've read stories where AI agents have deleted whole databases of information, wiping them clean, stuff that people had been spending years working on, just gone. I recently read a story where an agent was given a task and they wanted to see how far it would go. Well, it went so far as to impersonate real people, sending emails to real people, making phone calls with an AI voice to get access to systems that it didn't have access to in order to finish the work and work on the problem that it was given. Crazy, but it's happening. Security is being compromised because these agents are running without enough safeguards on the real work that they're doing. And so, the question that's being asked by the experts in the field is, what is the intent? What is the purpose? And without defined intent and guardrails, capable systems become very dangerous systems. I'm not trying to scare anybody away from using AI or tools, but rather to think. Take a moment and think. And I'm tying AI creation to our own humanity because it fits so well. Before Silicon Valley, before computers, going back all the way to Genesis 4, we have the story of Cain and Abel. You know, Cain and Abel both brought forth an offering before God. The same act. The same religious form. But God accepted Abel's and rejected Cain's. And why? Because of intent. Abel brought forth his offering from a place of genuine worship for God. He truly loved God. But Cain's heart was somewhere completely else entirely, and God saw through that. The capability was the same. The action looked the same. But the intent behind it was a difference between life and death. And when Cain's intent became corrupted, it went unchecked. It led to the first murder in history. This is what happens when capable systems run without the right intent. And so it was true for Cain and Abel, and it's true for all these companies using AI and building these systems. Again, looking at Genesis 11 and verse 6, it says, "And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them." God looked at the unified human ingenuity, and he saw exactly where it would lead without him. The intent was self-glorification, self-preservation, independence from God. Nothing has really changed since that time. The tower is now just a digital one. So why does this keep happening? Why does every generation of human capability end up in the same place? More power, more knowledge, but the same broken pattern. Recently, a friend introduced me to a man named Herbert Marshall McLuhan. He was a Canadian philosopher and media theorist who most people have never heard of, but his ideas seem very relevant today, maybe more so than when he wrote them. McLuhan pioneered what he called media ecology, the study of how technology and media shape human perception, values, and behavior. He was famous for coining the phrase, "the medium is the message," meaning it's not just what a technology delivers that matters, it's what the technology itself does to people using it. He predicted the internet and the concept of a global village well before either existed. Now, this man developed what he called the four laws of media, four questions to use to think about technology and to understand its impact. Those four questions are: what does it enhance or extend? What does it make obsolete? What does it retrieve? Something old that was previously discarded? And when pushed to its extreme, what does it reverse into? When used in, say, like the automobile, we can look at it like this. It enhances our ability to travel faster and farther. It made the horse and buggy obsolete, although some people would like to go back to a horse and buggy. It retrieves a very old human desire, the freedom to go wherever you want, whenever you want, and on your own terms. But pushed to its extreme, it reverses into gridlock, like living in LA or New York. The thing designed to make movement faster can actually stop you completely. Now, in applying that to AI, what does it do? It enhances human intelligence, speed, and decision making. It obliterates entire categories of jobs, skills, and ways of thinking we've had for generations. It retrieves an ancient human dream, the oracle, something all-knowing, you can ask anything and get an answer from, whether it's right or wrong. And pushed to extreme, it reverses into something no one controls. A system so capable, so autonomous, it operates entirely outside of human understanding or oversight. Every technology reveals something about humans. You know, most people never see what their environment is doing to them. It's because they're inside of it. They're focused on the content, the news, the feed, the information coming at them, the soccer games. I kid. They accept that the environment's assumptions are reality without ever stepping back, without ever asking, what is this doing to me? What is it doing to my mind, to my values, to my sense of what's real? Where is it leading my heart and my mind? McLuhan called this the invisible environment. The things that are nearest to us are the ones that we stop noticing because they're always there. They're always present. When was the last time you took a moment to step outside your environment long enough to examine what it's doing to you? Not what's in your Instagram or your Facebook feed. Not what the computer logarithm is going to serve you today. But what is the environment itself? The pace, the noise, the acceleration. What's it doing to our minds? What's it doing to our values? What's it doing to our sense of what really matters to us? Paul writes in Romans 12 and verse 2, something that I go back to a lot. He says, do not be conformed to this world. You see, conforming to this world is a very, very real possibility. And it's not just a moral warning about avoiding bad behavior. It's a media ecology statement that was written well over 2,000 years before McLuhan. What Paul is saying is, don't let the environment shape you without your awareness. Don't be conformed by the box you're living in, by the society. Step back, examine it. See the forest, not just for the trees, as that saying goes. The person who cannot see the environment is being formed by it, silently, constantly, without knowing it. And that invisible, unexamined information has been the enemy's strategy from the very beginning. Which leads us to my next question, or statement, which is, God has always been asking, what is the intent? I don't think that God is surprised by where we are headed. He's been asking humanity the same question since the garden. And the Bible points to the main issue in Genesis 6 and verse 5. Genesis 6 and verse 5 says, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was evil continually. God said this before smartphones, before the internet, before nuclear weapons, before AI. This is describing the default pattern the default setting of a human heart without God. We don't need to have quantum computing to have a corrupted intent problem. Humanity came out of the garden with one. Adam and Eve made a deliberate choice to set aside what God said to them, told them to do. They decided to figure out for themselves what was good and evil. Satan didn't even have to work that hard on them to get them to take from the tree of good and evil. The offer of, you will be like God on your own terms, by your own judgment, without submitting to him, that was enough. The self, choosing oneself over God, is what mattered the most to them. God saw that every intention of the thoughts of man's heart was evil continually. Not occasionally, not mostly, continually. When we turn to God, when we choose to live a different way of life, God doesn't upgrade our old intents, but rather he replaces them entirely. In Ezekiel 36 and verse 26, he says, I will give you a new heart and a new spirit within you, and I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. A completely, utterly different intent than what man has. And that's what it takes. In Matthew chapter 6 and verse 7, and this ties in with the editorial from this week, Christ is giving the Sermon on the Mount. But when you step back and you look at the whole picture that he was trying to get across in this message, it comes down to the intent behind the law. He opens with the Beatitudes, a complete inversion of what the world considers okay. It says, not the powerful, not the successful, not the religious performers, but the poor in spirit, the meek, the merciful, the pure in heart. Christ is showing what God values, and it's all about intent. Christ talked about the law, and he says, I didn't come to abolish it, but to expose it for what it was always pointing to. You heard, do not murder, but I'm looking at the anger that resides in people. You heard, don't commit adultery, but I'm looking at the lust. You've heard, love your neighbor, but what about your enemy? You see, every example that he gave follows the same pattern. The religious establishment had reduced God's laws to external behaviors, but Christ restored the original intent. In chapter 6, Christ talked about performance religion, if you will. He says, giving to be seen, praying to be heard, fasting to appear righteous. Those aren't bad things in and of themselves. Those are things that we are all supposed to do, fasting, praying. But what is the intent behind them? That's what he's getting at, is what determines everything. He says, if you're doing it for the audience, well, then the audience is what you're going to get. That's your reward. He also gave us the Lord's Prayer, the model of a right intent in how to approach God. It's about building a relationship, about building dependence, about building alignment with God's will. And then chapter 7 closes with the story that he gives about a storm hitting two houses. And what determines the outcome isn't the storm, but rather it's how those houses were built. What intent and foundation were they built with? What materials were used? This whole sermon in chapter 6 and 7 is showing that God knows the hearts of man, that he sees underneath the actions. He understands what the intent of your heart is, what the intent of my heart is. In Acts chapter 5, there is a story about Ananias and Sapphira. They sold property and they gave the proceeds to the church. On the outside, a genuinely very good act. But they held part of the proceeds back and then they lied about it. They were presenting themselves to be more generous than they actually were. The action looked righteous, but the intent was image management. And it cost them everything. The heart that was behind the act was what God was after. And the same pattern is played out over and over again throughout the stories in the Bible. The human pattern never changes unless the human submits to God and to be working on that intent. Saul had the title of the king. He was the leader of the army. He was anointed to this position. But in the end, his decisions were governed by fear of man and self-preservation. His whole intent was on his own survival. And yet, the outcome was losing his life, and quite possibly his eternal life. Versus David, a shepherd, a no one. And yet Scripture says that he was a man after God's own heart. Not because he was perfect, we know very far from it, but because of his intent at his core, he was oriented to God. Satan was with capability, but he decided to go on his own, to do his own thing, not to submit to God anymore. And what happened? We know. The experts building AI are terrified of what happens when a system that is highly capable is built without intent. And they should be. In a world where the experts are finally asking, what is the intent? Maybe we should stop and ask ourselves, what is our intent? In Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 23, we are told, guard your heart above all else, for it determines the course of your life. That question, what is your intent? It sounds simple, but if it was easy to answer and to act upon, then that pattern that we've been talking about would have been broken between Eden and now, would it have not? You see, the battle for our intent doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens inside of an environment that is actively and constantly and invisibly working to shape who we are. It's working on what we fear, what we believe to be true. Remember that McLuhan said, the invisible environment shapes us beneath the conscious awareness. The most powerful forces forming a person aren't the ones they can see and evaluate. They're the ones that are so close, so constant and familiar that they've become invisible. We're the same way with our environment. The pace, the noise, the scrolling, the notifications, the constant stream of information that surrounds us has become so ingrained in who we are that we can stop seeing it for what it is. We can accept it as normal. We can accept it as reality. But what is it doing to us? What is it doing to our thinking? What is it doing to what we value and what we were supposed to value as Christians? I think that's exactly why Paul said, don't be conformed to this world. He knew that the world doesn't ask permission to shape us. It just does it. Quietly, constantly. And unless we deliberately and intentionally step outside and examine what it's doing to us, we will just go along with the flow, with what is happening to us at that point in time. I'm reading a book called The Life-Changing Art of Self-Brain Surgery, and the doctor who wrote it, his name is Lee Warren. He's a neurosurgeon. He operates on human brains for a living. But he says in his book that up to 80% of automatic negative thoughts are cognitive distortions, meaning they are not true. The mind is generating fear, anxiety, and false narratives constantly. And most people never stop to question them. They just react and they let those thoughts drive. And I would say that the world's acceleration is turbocharging this process. AI, news cycles, endless streams of information. We are being trained to react rather than to stop and think. The environment is forming us whether we realize it or not. And the question is not whether you're being shaped, but rather the question is who is shaping your mind. Dr. Warren describes two things at play. He says that there's two designs at work. God's design: the mind exerts top-down control over the brain and body. You were built to govern your thoughts, not to be governed by them. And the second is Satan's strategy. Invert that. Let the external chaos govern the internal state. Let the environment do the forming. Let the context consume the attention. Keep people immersed in the box so that they never examine what the box is doing to them. Paul nails this in Romans 8, and beginning in verse 6. Romans 8 and verse 6, he says, "For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So then those who are in the flesh cannot please God, but you are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you." The carnal mind as Paul says, is at war with God. It doesn't want to submit. It doesn't want to please God. Left to itself, shaped by its own environment, running on its own intent, its enmity against God. But Paul gives the solution, how to overcome that. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5, Paul says, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Dr. Warren calls this a thought biopsy, a pause. Examine. Don't let the thoughts drive who you are. Look at the thoughts, hold it up against what God says, and decide whether those thoughts get to stay or if they need to go. He says that this is surgery. This is how you train yourself to step outside your environment rather than being consumed by it. He says that's what Romans 12 and verse 2 looks like in practice. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You see, Paul isn't talking about a yearly reset where we once a year look at who we are, what we've done, and decide to change, but rather this is a daily process. This is constant. Because the environment never stops working to form who we are. That means this renewal process does not stop either. God has designed that we have to have intentional and deliberate daily work. We have to choose to govern our own mind, or we let the world do it for us. In Matthew 24 and verse 24, Christ warned that false prophets would show great signs and great wonders. If we don't know what God's truth looks like, if we're too absorbed with the content of this world to examine our environment, that warning is that people will be swept away because they're sleeping. Do we understand how high the stakes are? Do we understand how important our daily practice is? What does this look like for each of us? In Psalm chapter 46 and verse 10, we read Psalm 46 and verse 10, "Be still and know that I am God." Sounds so simple. But when you read the rest of this psalm, you see that it wasn't written in a quiet moment. In reading verse 6, it says, "Nations are raging, kingdoms are falling, the earth itself is giving way." In the middle of total chaos, we are told, "Be still and know that I am God." God isn't saying be still when things are calm and easy. He's saying be still now. Before the noise tells you who you are and who you should be or what you should do. One of the most useful things that we can do in an accelerating world is to slow down. Not in passivity, not in checking out, but in intentional, deliberate slowness, stepping outside of our environment, knowing who God is, knowing who we are called to be. Paul puts it this way in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse beginning of verse 17. He says, Ephesians 4:17, "You should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God. But you have not so learned Christ, that you put off the old man which grows corrupt according to deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and put on the new man, which was created according to God, in true righteousness and holiness." You see, Paul is describing anyone whose mind is not being formed, or whose mind is being formed by the environment rather than by God. Anyone running on default settings. You see, the alternative is not to try harder. It's not just do better, but it's to put off and to put on. Two very deliberate acts. Strip away the old man, the old self, the self-oriented, carnally minded person, and put on the new man, the one that was created according to God. Put on the new man in true righteousness and true holiness. Again, that's a daily decision, a daily act of surrender to God on our parts. An intentional choice to be formed by God rather than the world. You can think about Daniel. Daniel lived in Babylon. Not by choice, but that's how he grew up. In one of the most advanced, most powerful, most sophisticated empires of its time. Everything about the environment that he lived in was designed to form him into being a Babylonian. They gave him a new name. They tried to enforce a diet upon him. They gave him education. He had people that he worked with. He had pressures of living in a daily life, as he was somebody in a high-ranking official position. Daniel didn't survive by trying to fit in, trying to become a Babylonian. He thrived by staying anchored into something that environment couldn't touch. 3 times a day, every single day, he got down on his knees and he prayed to God. Not when things were calm, not when things were just convenient, every single day he made this effort. He reoriented himself to God in these opportunities. It wasn't just a religious routine for him. It was him doing everything that he could to remain close to God, to make sure that the system that he lived in wasn't forming him. He put off Babylon every single day, and he put on God every single day. And God used him tremendously because he oriented himself to God. And brethren, that's what Monday morning should look like for us. That's what every single one of our days should continue to look like if we want to overcome this world. We are living, as I said, in a moment that Daniel was told to seal away. The knowledge explosion is here. Many people in the field are now just beginning to ask, what is the intent? You see that question while they are asking it. Maybe it's not just a technological question. They're just the latest generation to stumble into it. God has been asking this since the beginning. It's not about machines. It's not about towers, logarithms, rocket engine designs. It's about what is governing the human heart when nobody is watching, when nothing is stopping us. When you look at what happened in Eden, Cain and Abel, Babel, the Pharisees, Ananias and Sapphira, you see the same pattern repeating over and over. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the culmination of the ages has come. You see, these stories are not just about history. They're written down for us living in these end time age. They're written for people living in a time when everything is accelerating beyond what they've ever known. God's plan for humanity is to bring everyone, if possible, into his family. To make us, through his process, God beings in relationship with him. God is not scrambling. He is not surprised, but rather his timing is perfect. In Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20, it is a story of Joseph meeting his brothers. Joseph was left in a pit. He was sold into slavery. He was thrown into prison. Everything going wrong in his life from a very human measurement. And yet, underneath of it all, God's intent was running. Genesis 50 and verse 20. And when Joseph finally stood before his brothers, he said, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive." Human intent was running in one direction, and yet God's intent was running underneath all of it. And God's intent won. God's intent will always win. And so the question is not whether God's intent will prevail, but rather, will our intent become in line with his intent? C.S. Lewis said in Mere Christianity, "We have to be continually reminded of what we believe. Neither this belief nor any other will automatically remain alive in the mind. It must be fed." The world's environment is feeding each of us every single day. But we need to be thinking about what it means to choose differently every single day. We don't drift towards God. We have to choose him deliberately, daily. What's your intent when you first wake up in the morning? Is it to open your phone and look at what is going on in the world, what messages have come in through the night? Or is it to get down on your knees and thank God for another day, for new opportunities? Philippians chapter 4 and verse 6 to 9. Paul says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." And finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of a good report, meditate on these things. Set your intent on these things. How many times a day do we feel anxious? How many times do we allow anxiety to lead before we even realize that it's driving us? The peace that surpasses understanding is not something that we just stumble into. Oh, there's the peace I've been looking for. But rather, it's a fortress that we build brick by brick, day by day, thought by thought. It guards our mind. It is the guardrail that the tech world is so desperately searching for. Brethren, the world is running without guardrails. It's getting more and more dark, and the time is coming closer to Christ's return. The most important thing that we can do is to slow down. The most counterculture thing to do is to be still. The most powerful guardrail is to have the mind of Christ. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 16, Paul says, "Who has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ." Take the time to step outside the box. Examine whatever your environment you find yourself in and see what it's doing to you. Feed what you want to grow. Choose deliberately who you want to become. And then you can answer the question that God has been asking. What is the intent? Because your answer, not culture's answer, not some logarithm's answer, your answer is what changes everything.